Okay, this is talking with Mr. D.W. Heitman on 17 May 1981 over the phone from Cambridge to Clacton in Essex. First of all, can I ask what David D. stands for?
Dennis,
thank you.
With one N.
With one N, okay. Now, if I could also ask you, please, what your birth year was and something about your educational background and your profession through the years, especially during the 1930s when you were making these observations.
Well, I was born, funnily enough, in Clacton-on-Sea, which is where I am now, in December 1911.
Right.
Which makes me 69 now.
And what was your educational background?
After private schooling, I went to Colchester Technical College, which is about 18 miles from here. And I had a three-year course there, but typical of those days, I did not go on to university because my father was not a rich man and I didn't have the wherewithal. So
right.
At 16, I left school and became a technician in a company which was doing audio over cable, the early forerunner of cable TV as we know it now.
I see, but now audio, do you mean broadcasting?
We had high-power audio equipment at central stations and wired up towns with cable.
I see.
And in the houses, we just had a loudspeaker. And the speakers were fed direct with audio.
I see.
Much more simple than TV. This was a very good business in this country and many others. And my firm expanded considerably.
This is the late 1920s now?
The 1928. And I was in that company until 1934.
Which company was that?
It was the name of the company was Broadcast Relay Service Limited.
Mm-hmm.
And it was sold in the main to form a company called Rediffusion, which of course is now worldwide known from in many different activities, including cable TV.
Right.
However, I, with another young man, decided to start up in the radio business, radio repair and the general dealership, so
right.
We opened a shop, and that didn't do too badly. Sometime just before the war, also, I started manufacturing in a small way radio components.
You mean for serious high-fidelity people?
That's right.
Yeah.
So we had two companies, the one of them, which was called Denko Limited, was the component manufacturing setup, and the other company was called Super Radio, was a dealer operation. That brought us to the war, and the question arose, I was a relatively young man, what do we do? It looks though we'll be in the forces within 6 months.
Right.
I had a number of friends that were in the wireless reserve of the RAF, and I decided I'd better apply for a commission since I was already a very interested amateur, and I was doing signaling. I was okay, Morse code and all that sort of thing, and I had a transmitting license. In fact, when I got my transmitting license, which was about 1927, I think, I was one of the youngest license holders in the country.
I see.
In fact, it was issued to my father because I was too young. And so, of course, apart from running two businesses, I was operating on the air quite a bit from my home station, which had the call sign G6DH.
Right.
On my initials. And consequently, a number of my amateur friends had also volunteered for the what was called, I think, the Civilian Wireless Reserve.
Right.
I applied for a commission as a signals officer in the RAF. The papers were about 6 months in coming through, and in the meantime, we had to earn a living. So the radio business was tending to slow down with the uncertainty of the war.
Right.
And the manufacturing side, I thought I would close, but one of my friends had got into the RAF, and the Air Ministry in Whitehall wanted pretty quickly a portable type transmitter for RAF use.
Mm-hmm.
And all the big companies like Marconi's and so on were very, very busy. So he said, well, I've got a pal with a small company down at Clacton-on-Sea. I think I could get him to knock together a suitable transmitter in a short time.
Mm-hmm.
Cutting a very long story short, he ran down, gave me a specification, and in a fortnight, I'd put together an 80-watt HF transmitter, portable, which he took up to London, to the Air Ministry. And lo and behold, I got a telephone call. They wanted 40 more pronto.
I see.
And I got one of the first contracts that was issued. Then I had to think, well, I had about four people left working. This is a sort of change of the parting of the ways. What am I going to do if this these papers come through?
Right, right.
So I wrote to them, and they said, well, this is more urgent. We would like you to get on with it.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, I never went in the forces.
Right, so in 1940 this was.
That's right.
You just began manufacturing these things.
And I finished up with about 350 people. In two factories, manufacturing all sorts of service equipment.
I see.
Design, rapid manufacture, and so on, which skipped around the big companies, you know.
Right, and what was the name of this company?
This was Denco Clacton Limited, still running, actually.
And Denco is D-E-N-C-O?
Right.
Right.
It's partly formed from my name.
Right. Okay, that was...
You can realize I had to do a lot of training of people and get staff together and get the local females to solder and assemble things and so on. You often wonder where you got all the energy.
Well, okay, that gives me a good idea of the sort of work you were doing over those years.
Yes. It was a whole production and design setup in a small way, relatively small batch production of communication equipment, you'd say. Plus components for tanks and other things. I was doing work for the Army as well as the Air.
Right. Now can you give me a similar brief encapsulation of your career as a radio amateur?
Well, as I said earlier, I got my first... I, like most people, started building shortwave receivers and listening on the air, and then you hear the hams communicating with one another and you think you'd like to do this. So in 1927, I got the amateur transmitting line.
Right.
And in a very short time, I became more interested in the higher frequencies that they, the sort of 30 megahertz region and upwards.
And why was that?
Pardon?
Why did you become interested in those?
I think because they were stranger fields. I've always been looking for the unknown rather than the known.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
By nature.
Right.
I don't keep to the formal path.
Right.
And in 1928, which is the first sunspot maximum that I remember.
Yes.
The MUFs were going up. We didn't call them MUFs in those days.
Right.
Sometime, I think in October, I'd got a 10-meter receiver working quite satisfactorily, and I got quite a low-power transmitter. And I think it was somewhere around the 28th of October, I recall the date, we made the first contacts across the Atlantic from the United Kingdom with an American amateur W2JN, which is a call sign. I even remember that. I could probably think of his name if I thought long enough. But he had the first transatlantic VHF contact with a man called Matthews in England, and heard my little 3-watt transmitter.
Wow.
That was sort of getting things going. That was sort of the first big event I remember.
Right.
Excuse
me, let me just... Here now. So, after this first big event, as you say, then you obviously your appetite was whetted somewhat.
That's right, and we... in those days, built all our own equipment, of course. It was Japanese import.
Right, right.
It was even make your own resistors, coils, the lot. So you got to know how it ticked.
Right.
Much more than people do nowadays, and they're all tangled up with digital things. I think next year or two, we're largely taken with getting more powerful equipment, improving receiver sensitivity for a very low signal strength signal. all of the objects of hearing the impossible pretty well.
Right.
I think we were running down to sort of microvolts, very low microvolt signals, and questions of noise level, right, front end.
Right, became important, yeah.
Important.
There must have been very few amateurs operating at these frequencies.
Yes, they were, you could count them on one or two hands.
Right, so you all knew each other well then.
Yes, we got to know quite a few of them around the country and gradually filled up. I would be forgetting dates exactly, but I was going up in frequency and to, I suppose, the next band we had as amateurs was the 5-meter band.
Yes.
And I did quite a bit of work there. I became interested in sort of propagation as such and the effect of, the ionosphere and so on.
Right.
And tracing the time of events to sun and
right.
Time of day and all this sort of thing.
Now, when you say 5-meter band, is that right at 60 megahertz? Or?
That's right. It is, in fact, 60.
Right.
It used to run from 56 to 60, as I recall it. That would be pre-war. I had one or two contacts, and there were an increasing number of British amateurs getting going on these frequencies, and we started to get the first tropospheric propagation. We became aware that signals were extending beyond the optical range
right.
for various reasons of which we weren't too sure.
Right.
We also became aware of what was called sporadic E.
Yes.
were hearing signals over quite considerable distances, 1,000 miles or more.
Now, were you in close contact with the what you might call the professional researchers, such as at SLAW and so forth?
I'm trying to think, I might need a little notice of when I established contact with the Cavendish Laboratory at Cambridge and J.A. Ratcliffe.
Right.
Quite a bit of correspondence. And it was Biggs, was it? And
yes, Biggs was one.
Started the radio astronomy going there. What I'm lacking at this moment is the actual time scale, but I have got quite a bit of correspondence with all those people
right.
in the file.
But what I was interested in is that you were working with them in terms of what you were observing and
right.
and finding out what they knew about it. And
I found that they were interested, and in fact wanted to receive reports and so on
mm-hmm.
in various areas. So I kept up correspondence. I went to Cambridge two or three, well, several times before the war and after.
Mm-hmm.
And
did you attend the professional radio engineering or radio science meetings?
I have done some there, yes, that's so, not very often. But in between times, I became more professional. You'll realize that I was very largely amateur, self-taught,
yeah.
Up to about this time.
Indeed, yes.
I did a fair amount of night school and study at and in 1942, which is in the middle of the war, I took the examination to the Institution of Electronic and Radio Engineers, which
yes.
is our professional institution over here. And I passed that exam in 1942, and I became a graduate.
I see.
In 1979, I became president of the institution.
Oh, is that right? I didn't realize that.
Some year I won the Departmental Prize for a paper which is called Propagation of Metric Signals Above Beyond Optical Range or something. Or
and when was that published?
Must have been 1950 or somewhere around there.
I see. So you continued with this kind of research well after the war?
Yes. Oh, yeah. But within the capabilities, because that, in fact, skipping a little but staying after the war, I was presented again with one of these sort of things you have to decide in your life. I had to decide whether I tend to go more into the academic
right.
field or carry on and earn some money.
Right, right.
And I found I was mentally and, you know, so unequipped that I could have very easily gone in either direction.
Mm-hmm.
The depth of specialization in the academic field or in the wider field of management engineering, I
right.
think you would call it.
Right. And you chose the latter.
And I spoke to Dr. Smith Rose, who was... is a well-known name, of course.
Yes.
He became very friendly. I've worked on several CCIR committees and so on.
Right.
With him. And he said, well, you know, the problem you'll have is you don't have any university qualifications and so on. And you will tend to be up against that.
Yeah.
And I would advise you to go on into the commercial world. And so that's the direction I went in.
But mm-hmm.
nevertheless, I still kept this, you might say, as a interesting and fairly time-involving hobby.
Indeed,
I'd
yeah.
probably made more money if I'd left that alone and gone in on more into the... because I found I was quite capable of running organizations.
Right,
that.
Right.
And so that was the decision after the war, and I was trying to think, for reasons which would occupy a book, I sold my interest in my manufacturing company for about 1949-50.
Yes.
Because I was running into the problems that many founders do of necessary finance, especially after the war.
Yeah.
And losing control of the financial gentlemen.
Right.
Who had their thoughts, and I had mine, and I wouldn't be dictated.
Right.
So I switched to a very big company, which was called English Electric Company.
Yes.
As the chief television engineer.
I see.
And for 6 years I ran a design laboratory alongside the hard old world of production, with flow lines and all that, turning out domestic television receivers, and I was responsible for the design and engineering.
I see.
From there, I ran 6 years, and again, by one of these chances that comes, a good job was advertised, chief engineer of an international company based in London. I wanted to get back into the south of England. I preferred it to the north. So I got this job, which doubled the salary, and in a short while, probably a year or two, I was made the technical director of the company, which is expanded by merging, and then I was made group technical director with several factories and a television rental organization. I had the engineering responsibility for.
Oh, I see.
Then that company, which is called Radio Rentals, is a national company, had two merges, which eventually brought me through to my last setup, which was Thorn Electrical Industries.
Oh, yes.
Who merged with Radio Rentals. And I was made the group technical director of that, and I had a big sorting out job to do of people and facilities and so on. And just about when I was retiring, EMI was taken over by Thorn, so we became Thorn EMI.
Right. Okay, that gives me a pretty good rundown over there.
I finished as I say, group technical director in a large organization.
In fact, it occurs to me, if you do have a short biography or a resume that you'd be willing to send me, that would be a nice summary of all of this.
Yes, I do have that, I think.
That would be nice. But let's go back to the 1930s when you were doing research, basically, on the high-frequency propagation.
Sure.
And you said you made this contact across the Atlantic, and then you became interested in the correlations with ionospheric phenomenon of reception at different frequencies and so forth. So really, this discovery of this hissing noise was just one of many aspects that...
in which I was interested.
Right.
That's right. I think I wrote two or three articles in The Wireless World, which would summarize, I was apparently regarded as somewhat knowledgeable in those days on VHF propagation generally. And,
right.
I wrote, I think, a series of three articles for The Wireless World, full, several pages.
Right. Now, I have the one in April 38, which mentions the hissing noise.
I see.
If you could send me the others, I'd be interested, copies of the others.
Yeah.
In fact, do you actually have do they give you reprints in those days of...
The Wireless World didn't do reprints.
Oh, that's too bad. I would love...
Other papers, I have got reprints.
I would love to have papers...
Yeah, I can find that relevant.
I'll
include.
Yes, please do. Well, in any case, if you could send me copies of the other Wireless World ones that before the war,
yes,
that would be interesting to give me an idea of the other things that you were doing.
Okay.
Now, relative to this basic discovery itself, now can you tell me... what kind of an aerial you had and what kind of receiver and so forth?
Well, initially, I would have been using a long wire antenna, which was a periodic, and in other words, it wasn't tuned to any particular frequency.
Right.
This would be the type of antenna on which I first observed the hissing.
Right.
But very soon afterwards, I was using rotatable Yagi beams.
Oh, yes.
Both on 10 meters and 5 meters.
Mm-hmm.
In between, I would use a long wire antenna. When I say in between, I mean on intermediate frequencies.
Right. And the Yagi was something that you went up on the roof yourself and rotated around, or?
Yeah, well, I could rotate it from my radio room.
I see.
And I did get quite a few interesting results subsequently, because of course the immediate thing you start thinking about is what direction is it coming
exactly
from. And that's another subject, and I think it may have been after the war, but I can't recall exactly. I did find that with sporadic E conditions, I got considerable changes in noise level according to the direction in which I was pointing the antennas.
Mm-hmm.
I never finished up on this particular area of research, but it seemed to me to be quite possibly quite a good one, because everybody was in those days, and I think still to some extent, trying to decide the mechanism of sporadic E clouds, which were obviously very small areas in the ionosphere,
right,
and probably not necessarily parallel to the Earth's surface.
Mm-hmm.
There appear to be more than one cause possibly associated with upper air conditions other than just ionization.
Yes. Now, when you say you were finding about the directionality, was there something to do with the sun?
Yes. The direction of the hiss could be found to be stronger in pointing in the general direction of the sun. It was a very broad response, of course.
Yes.
But you could get a null when you turned it at right angles.
Right. Now, it would be very interesting to establish when that was, if it was before or after the war, if you could check that out.
Yes. I'll do that.
Okay.
Yes, because, of course, you could argue, well, Hay came along with the radar dishes and made a more positive.
Well, he had the directionality, obviously, and that's what I'm interested in, is that I don't find anything in the letters that you've quoted or in your own publications of directionality.
That's perfectly true, and I think it's unlikely that it was pre-war when I was doing this directional
work. Yeah, okay. Now, did the thought ever occur to you? Can you remember at that time that to build something sort of a la Jansky, or that was probably beyond your means to try to do something like that?
It was physically a problem. I had a space limitation in the grounds of my home.
Right.
The place looked like a commercial radio station as it was, and I was having local community troubles.
Right. You mean that this was not zoned for a commercial district? And
that's right.
Right.
It was purely residential.
Right, right. But still, do you remember that you, at that time, thought that, well, gee, it'd be nice to do this, and were you trying to figure out some way to get this done, maybe persuade someone else in the countryside to do it, or something like this?
Oh, yes, I think I undoubtedly had these thoughts. I was looking for new sites to live in with more space. But as I say, there are limitations to the amount of time and money as part of other things. So
right.
To get to this.
This was always a part-time hobby, really.
Right.
Right.
It could have easily been full-time, but there you are.
Right. Let me ask about the receiver you had. You said that they were all built by yourself.
Right.
Can you give me some idea what the noise figure would be?
We're getting into quite reasonable figures. We used, first of all, very early on, what you call receiving tubes weren't available, but I think the first time we were getting fairly good noise figures were with what were called acorn valves.
Right.
I've heard of these.
Yes.
Things, mainly made by people like RCA in the USA. And I would be guessing if I, without looking up, gave you, because we didn't have noise measurement figures in those days.
As such, yeah.
We were getting down to the very low, for those days, dBs. I didn't really get measurements until after the war.
Well, but what would you estimate, though?
I would have thought something like 6 dB, something like that.
Okay. And so we can recognize now that it would take a pretty healthy a burst to come across.
That's right.
Right.
Oh, yes, there's little doubt about that.
Yeah. And
you were hearing it when you were hearing it.
Now, let me ask once again, since I haven't had a lot of experience with this kind of thing, especially at low frequencies. I know something about interference at microwaves. This kind of hiss, it seems like you saw it as a very distinctive kind of thing, but were there a lot of cases where it was not clear what it was, or was it always a matter of it was definitely there or it wasn't there?
It was almost always had the same characteristic, which was very much, as I described it, like receiver front-end noise.
Right.
Listened to by ear, it was a smooth, constant hissing.
Right. Was it similar?
No time that I recall that there was any breakup or staccato sort of superimposed noise.
Right.
Quite different to any form of electrical interference or static. It was static, you know, from thunderstorms.
Yeah, yeah.
Very sharp. And one could imagine that, of course, we didn't have oscilloscopes and things available. But if you'd looked at it visibly, it would have been a random noise across the spectrum.
Right, just a lot of grass, so to speak. Okay, now, in your article in Wireless World in 1938, you say this is presumably caused by the arrival of charged particles on the aerial.
Right.
Now, why at that time did you suspect that that might be the cause?
Well, more particularly because it was the nearest type of static, again, listened to charged rain. We used to have in those days quite a bit of the noise, but more staccato from charged rain.
I see. I've never heard of this phenomenon. This is...
Thank you.
No.
Oh, yeah. Generally, but not always the case, sundry type conditions.
Yes.
The actual individual raindrops drop a charge on the antenna.
Mm-hmm.
And if you get pouring rain, you get this noise.
I see. Very interesting. And so it was just by analogy with that...
And it was the nearest thing that I'd heard to that.
Right. Now, but were you thinking that these were particles which had been charged secondarily from the sun, or that these were direct charge particles from the sun?
Well, direct charge.
Direct. So they were going right through the Earth's atmosphere.
And arriving.
And hitting your aerial. Okay.
We, of course, later on realized that it's extremely unlikely that they would be unaffected. In other words, they would be affected by the Earth's magnetic field.
Right.
And corpuscular type particles, which happen to be shot off at the same time as these eruptions, but take longer, were the things which were arriving more in the polar regions and causing the aurora and so on.
Right. But now, can you tell me how this thought developed? I mean, what was the next step as you began to get more and more of these hiss phenomena?
The things we thought about were, apart from time, the spectrum, and I used fairly wide spectrum receivers, and we found, for example, that the strength of the hiss across the spectrum was quite different and often fell off at relatively low frequencies, and it was quite audible up to quite high frequencies.
Mm-hmm.
I'm now talking in the range of, say, 1 to 60 or more megahertz.
So 60 megahertz was the highest that you ever got to?
That was the receiver limitation,
right,
mainly.
Now, you weren't making any quantitative measurements, though, of the intensity?
No.
What was the limitation why you couldn't do that?
Well, I think the to some extent events overtook us, but it's true to say that when I got to the after-war condition, we did have S-meters on receivers, and it would have been possible to make comparative signal strength measurements.